that this morning.
You ready?
Services Committee, House Committee on today, January 28th, 2009. Thank you all for being here. And today we're going to have an informational hearing on the Department of Human Services. Dr. Goldberg, I think you're going to come first. You want to bring anybody up with you? Are you just a star? You can come alone.
You're a welcoming group.
Madam Chair,
yes.
May I say something before the doctor here speaks? Just want to point it out that the boys were here first this morning. We were all well prepared in our places.
Could you make sure that we get little gold stars and all those little ones? Thank you, Zach. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm director of the Department of Human Services. And pleased to be here this morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief and just provide a very brief overview, and then we're going to have each of our division heads or their representatives come talk with you about the work that we do. But what I wanted to do was just spend a couple of minutes providing an overview of the department from, you know, the perspective of what we do. Now, I'm privileged to lead a department that really is involved in improving the lives of pretty much every person in this state. It's pretty dramatic, and it really is a privilege to be able to do that. We help people become healthy, help assure that we've got a healthy state and a healthy environment. We help keep people safe. We do what we can to see that people become self-sufficient, help with mental health care needs, health care, food security, job training, emergency cash assistance, an array of services. I mean, and just to give you a sense, we help provide food stamps to 435,000 people in the state. That's almost 15%. And, in fact, have received a bonus from the USDA for the fact that we're one of the top five states in terms of the highest percentage of eligibles that we've been able to reach and get on food stamps. We provide medical coverage on the Oregon Health Plan to over 400,000 people. Mental health programs serve over 100,000 people. Our addiction treatment programs help over 64,000 people. Provided emergency cash assistance to 18,000 people, nearly 12,000 seniors. And people with disability get services through our department. We provide child welfare services and protect thousands of children, over 10,000 children in our child welfare system today. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And we don't do it alone. I mean, the biggest issue is that, you know, we provide these services through an array of community partners. And when you look at our budget and how we're staffed, it's always interesting to me because we're often seen as a large state bureaucracy. And when you dial down on that, and you'll get a sense of that today, we have a large budget. I know this isn't a budget committee, but, you know, approximately $6 billion a year. Over 60% of that is federal funding. 9,800 staff, but almost between 80 and 85% of our dollars, that $6 billion, actually go out to Oregon communities every day. They're not spent on us here in Salem or on state employees. They are really to provide services. Those are dollars for food stamps. Those are payments to doctors, nursing homes, home health care workers, you name it. We provide about $13 million a day into Oregon communities, which is pretty astounding. And that's really in direct dollars that go either to Oregon citizens in the form of food stamps, emergency cash assistance, payments to foster parents, or payments to home health aides, health care providers, etc. And we touch the lives of all Oregonians through a range of the public health programs that we do, where we're really responsible for helping improve the health and preventing illness for everybody. It's assuring safe drinking water, our health promotion and disease prevention programs, newborn health screenings, the work that we do in terms of tobacco use prevention, oversight and regulation of hospitals and healthcare facilities to assure that when we go into those that they're safe and people get the care that they need. We are organized, as I indicated, in six divisions, and you'll hear about from each of those today. And the six are, we have the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, which is the Oregon Health Plan, Public Health Division, Addictions and Mental Health Division, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, and Children, Adults, and Families, which is responsible for child welfare and the self-sufficiency programs, TANF, food stamps, etc. And our sixth division is an administrative services division, which is really an umbrella for the department to be able to share administrative services and run efficiently and effectively. And, you know, and as I indicated, we don't do this alone. We provide actually very little direct service. Most of the service that we provide is through all of the health and safety providers that exist in communities. We're guided by values. We have five departmental values, which are integrity, stewardship, responsibility, respect, and professionalism, and they really do guide our work. We need to be a values-driven organization, and we also need to be performance-driven. You know, we evaluate the success of what we do based on our ability to prevent problems, what we can do in terms of the ability of people to access services in an appropriate manner, and are working hard on that. Service quality, which is both customer satisfaction as well as the ability to keep people safe and provide that measure of quality, and our ability to be organizationally effective. Part of what we've embarked on over the last year has been, I think some of you have heard about it, has been an organizational-wide transformation initiative, which really has been, you know, an effort by us to take a very serious look at who we are, how we function, to be able to work more efficiently and effectively. We've been engaging the McKinsey Corporation to really transform how we do business around five themes. One is doing work the right way first, so that's reducing error and working more efficiently, getting more from the public dollar. As I indicated, a lot of public dollars come through our agency, whether that's state or federal dollars, and what we need to do is assure that we use those as efficiently and effectively as possible. We need to develop world-class people and a world-class culture, and that's something that we're working to do. We need to do better at working across our divisions and our programs. That's one of the reasons why we are the agency that we are. And we are the agency that we are because from the perspective of a client, they rely on many of our services. And it's not unusual to have somebody come in who is a senior who needs help in terms of long-term care planning and assistance at home, but is also food stamps. And they may have a child at home who they're responsible for, who needs access to health care. We know that when we look at child welfare, 60% of kids who are in the child welfare system are there because their parents have untreated mental health or substance abuse problems. So it's critical that we look at how all of these programs function together in a way that makes sense. And then the last theme of our ability to transform ourselves is engaging with all of our partners to also improve their performance as well, all of us together working to do that. And then I think the last comment I would make before we get to the division presentations is, our relationship with you, the legislature. And I think that there are two themes or issues I'd just like to point out. One is the role of the legislature in oversight, which I think is vitally important. And, you know, we look to be able to be transparent and accountable and to work with you as the representatives of the citizens of the state to assure that we're doing our work in the best way possible. I think that there needs to be a strong oversight and partnership function in how we do that. The partnership piece comes in the second theme, and that's in policy development. I mean, we're really responsible and look to you, and I hope you also look to us around policy development. And our job is to carry out that policy, and hopefully in the best way possible. I think it's also to help inform you as you get informed from your constituents and a variety of others around the state into what some of the policy needs are in the state. How we care for our neighbors with mental illness. You know, huge policy issues around where and how we site facilities and how we organize and configure our mental health system. Huge policy questions that, you know, we will do our best to both, A, provide information to you to be able to make the right decisions, and B, for us to carry out that policy in the right way. I mean, you could say in each of our sort of programmatic areas, whether that be child welfare or what we do about temporary assistance for needy families or how our long-term care system is organized in our communities, we really look to the legislature to set the policy for the state, and then it is our job to carry that out. And I hope that we as a department are able to work closely with you over this session, between sessions, and always to be able to do that in the best way possible. I hope you always feel comfortable to be able to call on us, that you'll get the information that you need, and that we will be responsive. So with that.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. Any questions of Dr. Goldberg, representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, thank you. I love your quote at the very beginning, at least it's what I wrote down as a quote. We help people to become healthy. I mean, I really like that concept of restoration. And I actually, a lot of the stuff that I tried to do, I mean, over the last 4 years, focused toward that direction. I have a two-part question here, and it deals with alcohol and drug treatment. I know that that's going to be, talked about a little later on today. My first part with it is, in the governor's recommended budget, he's got somewhere, he is removing about 75% to 85% for treatment providers dealing with alcohol. So I'm just kind of curious your thoughts along that line. What are we going to do to try to keep these centers open?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I'm very concerned about the reductions in funding for alcohol and drug treatment, as well as for mental health, because I do think that they are about, as you indicated, prevention, and we're trying to, as a department, focus more on prevention and front end rather than taking care of issues further down the line. It's a more effective way of, A, dealing with our state resources, and I also think it's a better way and a more humane way of, and a just way of, taking care of people. So it concerns me from a number of perspectives. It concerns me in terms of those individuals who have mental health and substance abuse problems. It concerns me about what that's going to do within child welfare, what it's going to do within our criminal justice system, mm-hmm. and the downstream effects of those reductions. What are we going to do about that? I think that the governor's budget has one strategy, which is, and I don't think this is the sole answer, and I don't mean to in any way imply that, but one strategy is to be able to restore some of the enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan. And certainly through that, there are many low-income families who would be able to get alcohol and drug treatment as well as mental health treatment through the Oregon Health Plan. I don't think that's a one-to-one switch, but I do believe that that will help. I also believe that we need to look to at ways we, as a state, can restore those cuts. I'm hoping that the federal stimulus package will help provide some additional means to be able to do that. And, you know, I think this is a time when we've got to prioritize. It's certainly a big priority for me.
I just have one follow-up, then. Thank you. Then just kind of a continue. Thank you. I don't mean to be putting you in a rock and a hard spot here.
I don't feel that at all.
Very good. Thank you. The other thing, I was deeply involved with crafting the language for Measure 57 a year ago. And as you know, there was that companion bill, House Bill 3638, $40 million treatment piece as well. And I'm involved with that work group for the direction of where we're going with that right now. My thought on that is if we're going to be in a position of closing the treatment centers, should that occur, what impact is this $40 million? You know, there's the balancing act that is just going to be really pretty terrible. I'm curious your thoughts.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I'm very concerned that it puts our whole system out of balance. Mm. And to put it bluntly, I think what it does is it says that you need to commit a crime before you'll be able to get alcohol and drug treatment, and I think that's backwards. Personally, I think the issue is how can we afford people the treatment that they need beforehand. I don't think this is either or, and I think that's I think these are the right questions and the right discussions, and I think we have to move away from, one of the things that's always difficult for me, and I know is difficult for you, is as legislators, is that sometimes we get pushed into should we put $40 million in the criminal justice side or in the community-based alcohol and drug treatment? You know, the answer is yes. we've got to figure out a better way than just making these Sophie's choices. But I think we've got to, and I think we have to maintain, I think you hit the right word, which is we've got to, regardless of what resources we have, I think the issue is to be certain that we maintain a balance. And the other piece is that we're able to assure that during a difficult financial time, we don't decimate a provider system that may take a couple of years to build back when resources do come in. So I think it's a balancing act.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm not sure, did the new folks here realize what 3637 was and 37? Does anybody need any further explanation on that? Representative, are you okay there?
Yeah,
okay. Okay, Representative Dimbrough, okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative
Thanks. Dimbrough. And before I ask my question and comment, I want to thank you for all your people. You're probably the first most called agency in my office. And usually it's an email to Patio or somebody and Mickey, and everybody's just been so responsive. I never think about it again. They just do it. good people.
Well, thanks. And if I didn't say it, I need to really stress that we've got, you know, 9,800 really, really committed good people.
So Representative Olson kind of took the words out of my mouth, surprisingly. He's had more coffee than I have this morning, but he hit the nail on the head, and I wrote down some of the numbers when you were giving them in the beginning, and they start big numbers with the food stamps, and that to me is like the state's and federal's way of helping people, you know, get what they need, and that's the healthy part. 400,000 on the health plan, 64,000 with addiction, and 10,000 kids in the welfare system. And I'm thinking out of that, and then you said 60% of the kids in the system have parents or a parent with drug and alcohol problems. So, you know, the case of starting to address that, if you address it with the treatment, then you get that under control, then you get the kids out of the system, then you get people back to work, and I mean, you can work your way up, and then they'll be able to provide their own food. And I know that sounds simplistic, but I think we're going at it the wrong way with the cuts like that to these integral pieces of the puzzle, mm-hmm. because I see it, and when you have alcohol and drug treatment, you usually have criminal activity, and then kids are taken away because their parents are in jail or whatever, and it also becomes, and I remember this from way back in 2005 when we visited the treatment centers over one in the East Side and one in Eugene. And all of those women, they were all women, they were all of them, had at least one child and maybe one on the way or whatever, but a lot of them had three or four or five kids. And so all of those kids are in the system because of drug and alcohol addictions. So it just seemed to me like, let's fix that first. Or, you know, I know you can't not do the other things at the same time, but prevention really should be the top priority. And I know you believe that too.
Couldn't agree more, Chair Tomei and Representative Boone. I think these decisions have to be looked at. There's certainly difficult short-term decisions that sometimes need to be made about budgets, but I think they have to be made with exactly that perspective. Is you may save in the short term, but in the long term, these aren't just about humane ways of dealing with our resources and taking care of our neighbors. It also sometimes doesn't make long-term fiscal sense and programmatic sense for a state. And I think that's how we have to have this conversation.
And just a quick follow-up. And I guess my final statement would be is, if we don't do it, we're just going to perpetuate this, because it's just as in a lot of things, child abuse, those kids learn that. That's what they will do when they have kids. A lot of parents actually give their kids drugs and alcohol. And so it will keep going. The kids will drop out of school because they can't go to school stoned, or they just don't, and there's no support for them there. And I just see this ball rolling down the road, just generational. Anyway. Thank you. You're indulging me.
Thank you.
I get going. Sorry.
I know you do. Your heart is there. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Having been a Head Start director for 22 years, it's very important for me to say that in the governor's budget is a recommended expansion of Head Start. And although I laud that and applaud that, one of the issues I think that's extremely important is that Head Start is not just about education. It's about comprehensive services. And the children won't succeed if we can't help the family succeed. And every blue page in this, Head Start will link up with the department to provide help to families so that they will succeed, for children to have health care. And I will tell you this, Dr. Boldberg, our program operated in two states, five counties, two in Washington State and three in Oregon. And I want you to know that the staff in Hood River and Wasco County have got to be the shining stars for you. because they put in the extra time to do the needs of the to meet the needs of the families and especially the children. And I especially am appreciative of the services the department provides for those families who need child care and trying to get them qualified so that they can get into the Head Start program for child care. So I think for me it's very paradoxical that we want to give children a chance to succeed, but the reality is that Head Start needs the services of the department in order to be successful. And that was a comment, I'm afraid.
Well, can I... Sure. Two comments back, Representative Tomei and Representative Van Orman. I think the issue is that we've got to stop looking at all of these as being about programs, because I think what you're saying is this is about kids and families.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get into some of these budget discussions, we think about this from a programmatic way.
Mm-hmm.
Head Start's usually important, and I think that's key. So is healthcare for kids and their families, and we build on top of that. And I just want to say that I'm very aware of some of the great things that have gone on in Hood River. In fact, wanted to come talk with you about a program that you did to help provide parents with greater information about children's health that seems to really do a couple of things. One, help kids be healthier, and number two, help reduce healthcare costs.
That's correct.
And
be very happy.
Great. I think that's something we need to do around the state.
Thanks, Dr. Goldberg. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, in the handout, which you didn't really talk about, which is fine, you say that there are more than 300 programs in DHS.
Correct.
Have you prioritized those programs? And I know that really is contradictory to what Representative Van Orman's perspective is, but still at some point programs are about the dollars. And so have you prioritized those programs?
Representative Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, we have. And I will tell you it's very difficult. And there's two issues around that. And happy to share our prioritization with you. Here are the two issues. We've done that, and we've done it in prioritizing all of those 300 programs or thereabouts. Some of them are lumped together. I think there's about 80 or 90 that we've prioritized. When you do that as one department, it becomes a really difficult question as to how you prioritize a senior service versus a child care service. And those become really difficult choices. Where I think it's a better exercise and where what we need to do is to look within how we deliver senior services, what are our priorities and our policies for how we do that, and within alcohol and drug treatment and mental health, how things are prioritized. I think is a better discussion. And the last piece I would say is oftentimes what our priorities as an agency or your priorities as a legislature are sometimes different than what the federal government's priorities are, which often set what are some of the mandatory minimums that we need to do. So it makes some of those discussions difficult. I think they're hard. It's something we struggle with quite a bit, and I'm happy to share with you the list for what it's worth given those caveats.
I would appreciate that list, because I think that you can bleed programs across the board, and that's only effective to a certain point. At some point, a cut within a program makes it dysfunctional, and so it's rather than bleed all programs, you lop off the ones that would be discretionary, may not be the right word, but ones that are not required by the federal government or required by statute. And then retain those services because we are going to bleed out if we don't make changes in this state, and we are not going to survive. And so I think it's incumbent, we're going to have to make some really hard decisions, maybe not in this committee, but we are part of that voting block that will make some really hard decisions, and I just want to have the best information available to make those tough decisions that make the best sense, you know, keeping in mind that wraparound is really important.
Happy to share the list, just so long as you don't think of it as the best information. I'm not certain how great it is, but I think it can help.
I hope it's better than I would produce, just because you're in the midst of it.
It's a very hard exercise to do.
So are you saying this list is somewhere printed out so that we would be able to see it, Dr. Goldberg? And that's something you would be willing to share with the whole committee?
We're transparent, no secrets.
I appreciate that.
I think that it's just important that these kinds of lists be considered in a couple of contexts. One, it's difficult. Two, that they're, you know, from our perspective as an agency, and I know for you as a legislature, some of this also becomes which child do you love the best? I mean, I often have that discussion with my 22 and 18-year-old daughters who have different perspectives on that. And no matter what, I mean, I think that sometimes some of those things come into that, and I think prioritization is really hard. And I just wouldn't want this list to be taken as something chiseled in stone. It's some thoughts. We can provide some of the ways that our different divisions sort of approached it. But
maybe it should be presented here at committee rather than sending us something that is black and white but is really pretty gray and lavender and red.
Well, my sense is it may be better just to give you it, let you look at it, and use it for your own purposes, as opposed to, I mean, quite frankly, having a hearing and having it be seen as, I think, something that it's not. I think it's a guide, it's a draft, it's some thinking, it's not kind of the end-all and be-all of a list. And I'm sensitive to oftentimes, I think transparency is wonderful, and try and be transparent. I also just want to always be sensitive to how the context and the way in which information is perceived and used, and I wouldn't want it to be, I think, let's say, formalized in that way, because I don't think it is that. I don't think this is what we've put together isn't, 6 months of our best thinking, and here's a really great list for you to use. It's an exercise we went through, and we're happy to share it.
Thank you.
Our
time is running out. We have several people. We can also ask these people to come back. I think this is a very important discussion that we're having. And so my inclination is to continue with this, and we might ask other people from the divisions to come back. Does that seem appropriate, Dr. Goldberg? Are you short on time?
I've got
two
more
questions
minutes
over here, and then I think maybe somebody over here.
I just had a point. I just need a clarification.
Okay. Representative Cowan, Representative Dembro, and then Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for affording the time. I really feel it necessary to make a comment at this point because I think that this conversation has taken what I consider a frightening turn. I have a great deal of difficulty with prioritization lists, because as soon as that sort of thing gets talked about as your primary direction, you start talking about what's on the bottom and what gets lopped off. And I would really, I just need to strongly encourage us in at this stage of the conversation that we need to talk about what we can do to maintain that balance and to focus on not just prevention, but what's the most cost-effective long-term way of delivering services. I certainly would be remiss not to remind us, as we started some conversation about long-term care and discussions with people for services with to seniors and people with disabilities, that the downside of not providing early intervention and direction is horrendous cost at the other end of the system as people move into what is then the care we're obligated to provide. And I was struck when we listened to the presentation on PSRB and some of the services that are provided to individuals as we try to relocate individuals into our community. That comes with treatment, that comes with medications being provided, et cetera. And then when the comment was made, does one need to commit a crime in order to get the services they need? That was sort of what was running through my mind. We have to think about what we're doing and what the long-term costs, even in the face of this kind of urgent crisis. So I don't know. If we move directly to talking about a prioritized list, I would just be sick. And
we're
had not to say that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We're not going there. We're trying to get an overview of this department.
Thank you.
Of this agency and the various departments. And we're not moving into the point where we're going to be talking at all about any how this committee will prioritize issues. So thank you for that warning. And
I just had to get it on the record.
I appreciate that. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate those comments by Representative Cowan as well.
I was trying to say, but was probably not quite as articulate, so thank you.
Not sure that it's articulate. Just
yeah, and, you know, I really appreciate your commitment to transparency, and I too am not really that interested right now in the actual list, although if my colleagues get it, I'd like to get it too. But, you know, what I'm really more interested in actually is the principles that you're using in developing the list, because that's what, you know, I'm going to have to explain to my constituents, I think. And ultimately, when, you know, we as a body really address those cuts, hopefully they will be principle-based. And so your help with that, I think, would really be useful.
Chair Tomei and Representative Dimbrough, I'll be happy to do that. You know, I think that gets at the larger issue, which is when you look at what we do, you know, much of what we do is taking care of the most vulnerable. And I think that's what Representative Cowan was getting at, is when you prioritize what we do, you're prioritizing the vulnerable on top of the vulnerable. And I think these exercises need to be at a larger level in terms of what is it and where do we put state, you know, what is the role of state government in helping the most vulnerable? What's often very difficult for us as an agency is this fact that when budgets are tight, you know, we're looked on to, you know, balance the needs on the backs of the most vulnerable. Right now we're seeing, you know, 15% and 20% increases in our caseloads. I mean, what I didn't tell you about food stamps and cash assistance, I gave you the numbers of people on that. The bigger story, it's not a budget committee, so I didn't want to get into it, is the fact that, you know, quite frankly, we've got 15.5% more people on food stamps in this state than a year ago. And in some parts of the state, it's 40% more. I mean, it's astounding. And in terms of cash assistance, it's 15% more people coming to the state for cash assistance. And just to give you an idea of who those people are, the individuals who qualify for cash assistance live below 43% of federal poverty. So what that means is we have a 15% increase in the poorest of the poor over the last year. And in some parts of the state, it's 20 and 25%. So that's what makes these prioritization exercises difficult, is we've got more and more need, and how do we prioritize on the backs of those who are the most needy? These are difficult questions, and they keep me awake at night.
Can I just ask a follow-up? Thank you, Chair. you know, one of the short-term strategies that the governor was talking about was some furloughing of state employees. Can you say something about what the effect of that would be on the services, you know, the trade-offs that we would have to bear in order to save money that way?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrough, let me give you just the situation in our agency, and it really fits with what I just indicated. 6 months ago, we began a hiring freeze in our agency to deal with what have been increased caseloads and increased expenditures. And what we're seeing in our agency is more need for our services. As I indicated, 15-20%, in some parts of the state, 40% more people coming in. As that's happened, we've instituted a hiring freeze. So we're already, I'm very concerned about the ability of our staff. I'm concerned about two things. I'm concerned about, A, the ability of our staff to continue to do that work without hurting themselves. And I'm concerned about our ability to provide the kind of service that we need to individuals in our communities. I mean, this is, it's a difficult time. So if then we're looking at within what we're doing, furloughing individuals, I think that in our agency, that adds to that. I mean, we've declared, and just to give you a sense, I mean, we've, and Erin can talk to you a little bit about it when she comes up. I mean, we've, in essence, declared our own state of emergency. Not that we have official powers to call a state of emergency. I'm not trying to usurp anybody's power, but I think that we've begun to look at how we deliver services, certainly around food stamps and TANF, in a different way. And we're looking at deploying some of our staff who are in Salem out into the field to meet those needs, which means there's things that aren't going to get done because we're prioritizing being able to get food to people who need it and be able to get people the health care benefits they need. It's difficult. So, I understand the budgetary reasons for furloughs. From our point as an agency, I think it'd be very difficult.
Thank you, Bruce. I'll pass it. Okay. I think we've gotten into much deeper issues than had been my intent, but I think it's been very illustrative of the situation that we're in and we're going to have to be dealing with the next few months. You've got us here, so did you have?
My concern is that we are looking at a approaching $3 billion deficit below the essential budget level, just as a benchmark. And that we can delay the conversation or we can just start to have it. And so my preference is to start to have it so that it isn't, you know, it's going to be dramatic anyway, but that we can at least be part of that conversation. And that's my point. And I'm sorry, there's going to have to be cuts to services. There is no way around that conversation. So, you know, it's not that I want that, but let's do it smart. And I really do give him a lot of credit, Dr. Goldberg, you, for your ability to do it.
And keep smiling?
And keep smiling.
This is a very difficult time for all of us in Oregon. And I think we're all going to be measured by how we deal with the next year or two.
One last thing, Dr. Goldberg. You mentioned the McKinsey report. So will we have access to that?
Sure. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, absolutely. It's available online right now, but what we'll do is give you, I'll be certain that you all both have the link for those who like to read things electronically and some copies for those of you who like paper.
Terrific.
How's
Thank
that?
You so much. Any last questions of Dr. Goldberg? Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate all that you do for the state. Thank you. Aaron Kelly Seal.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Kelly Seal, and I'm the Interim Assistant Director for the Children, Adults, and Families Division. A lot of the issues that we are facing in our division already have been introduced, and I will try not to be repetitive. I want to start by just giving you a little bit of perspective about the policy continuum that our division supports. We provide, as you heard from Bruce, many of the most essential services that meet people's most basic and urgent needs. Through our child protective and child welfare system, we help keep children safe, and we restore family stability. And also through the self-sufficiency system, our self-sufficiency programs, we help provide family stability that keeps children safe. Our self-sufficiency programs also are part of a larger continuum in Oregon that help people be economically stable and secure, find gainful employment. And so does our program that serves people with disabilities, the vocational rehabilitation program. I think it's also been noted here that a lot of our clients that we serve are facing many complex issues. And so we work with community partners to address those issues as we deal holistically with families. Issues like addiction and mental health. It's very difficult to be economically secure and independent when you're struggling with an addiction issue or a mental health issue. So those services are services that we, through our division, contract for and work to get into place for families so that they can achieve their goals, either their employment goals or be able to safely protect and parent their children. We have three primary program areas in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, and the handout you have describes in some level of detail what those program areas include, and so I'm not going to focus too much on a description except to say that within the Child Welfare Program area, which I view as part of a safety continuum, we do several things. We respond to calls reporting abuse and neglect. If abuse and neglect has occurred and the parent cannot keep their child safe, we then intervene, and sometimes that means a child goes into foster care, and we administer the foster care program for the state of Oregon. We also then work very diligently and hard to get children home, and we provide in-home services that support that effort, and if we cannot do that, then we provide other alternative placements and support adoption services for children so they can have permanency in their lives. In our self-sufficiency program area, you've already discussed several of our larger programs. We help people meet their basic food needs. We administer the federal food stamp program. We provide people the temporary assistance for needy families program provides people emergency cash assistance and job support training and helps people get employed. And our employment-related daycare program subsidizes child care for very low-income working families. Those are three primary programs in that area. We also have staff who do the medical eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, which you will hear more about in terms of the service delivery later. And we operate the refugee program for people who are here legally fleeing oppression in their home countries. And we have a significant responsibility to meet the needs of victims of domestic violence as well. In our vocational rehabilitation program, we work with people with disabilities to help support their employment or provide them with rehabilitative services so they can be employed, and that includes young people who are transitioning out of foster care, and about 60% of the people that we serve through our vocational rehabilitation program have a mental illness. So we are part of that continuum for the mental health system as well. You heard some statistics from Dr. Goldberg, and at the risk of not wanting to deviate from the numbers that he gave you, I think that the need for our services, especially in today's economic times, is pretty self-evident. And you heard from Dr. Goldberg about some of the ways that we just statistically the numbers of people that we serve and make every effort to meet those needs. I'll be back at. Thank you, Madam Chair, next Monday and Wednesday to talk a little bit more about our child welfare foster care program area and adoption. But I just wanted to let you know that in 2007, we performed around 21,000 safety assessments to ensure child safety. We served about 15,000 children in foster care on average every month. About 9,000 children in Oregon are in foster care. We served about 7,400 children in their own homes. 64% of children who enter foster care go home and are reunited with their parents. Nearly 1,000 children who were in foster care in 2007 were adopted, and we provided adoption assistance or guardianship assistance to over 11,000 children last year. You also heard some statistics about some of the work that we do to meet families' most basic needs. In total in 2008, 600,039 Oregonians, 1 in 8, received food stamps. There were 520,000 individuals on the food stamp program in the month of December. Over 21,600 families received emergency cash assistance, and over 18,500 low-income working families received child care subsidies. 6,275 families with 10,690 children escaped domestic violence and received assistance from my division. And nearly 14,700 people with disabilities received services from our vocational rehabilitation program. I think one of the ways that CAF is unique for the Department of Human Services, you heard about our 9,800 employees. Around 4,000 of those employees are in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, serve the Children, Adults, and Families, and we do directly serve children and their families with our child welfare and our self-sufficiency case management and vocational rehabilitation services. We have 4,000 staff in 100 offices across the state doing self-sufficiency and child welfare work, and we have 34 field offices working with the vocational rehabilitation program. I just wanted to share a little bit of perspective on some of the policy issues that are facing us. Some of our challenges and opportunities already have been discussed in terms of just the significant caseload increases that we're facing as a division. As Bruce said, in TANF over the past year, we've seen a 16% increase statewide, and in food stamps over the past year, we've seen a 15% increase statewide. And to cover part of that need, CAF is actively engaged in what Bruce mentioned also, the transformation effort, which is basically an effort for us to streamline and improve the quality of the services that we provide and relieve some of the workload pressures for our very hardworking staff so that they can spend more time with clients, better serve clients, and we have a series of work that's going on there, some of which we're very excited about. As it relates to the food stamp program, there are some offices, because of the caseload increases, who have had to turn people away for weeks at a time. And often people are waiting until the very last moment because some of the people who are seeking services right now have never done so before. And so they come to us, and they can't meet their family's food needs. And we, because our caseloads have been so overwhelming, have had to ask them to come back. And that is an extremely hard place for a staff person to be when they are working with a very hungry family. And so we are rolling out statewide an improved intake process that will allow us in every office to offer same-day service to people who come in our door and in effect provide a higher quality of service and meet needs more quickly, which is also something our staff are very much looking forward to being able to do. So that's just one example. of how transformation is impacting CAF, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that as the weeks and months go on. We've had several workload studies, as Bruce noted, and we are significantly understaffed in our program area. And we are having, in the TANF, our Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, last session in 2007, this committee actually spearheaded a total redesign of that program. And I'm really proud to tell you that when we implemented that redesign for the first year of its implementation, we were very much on track to achieving the results that this committee set out for us to achieve. We were better serving people with disabilities. We were better serving children to keep their families safe and stable, and we were achieving stronger and better employment outcomes for families in the program. With the caseload increases, we've been having to prioritize the work that we do in that program, and some of the budget challenges that we're facing, I think, really are going to challenge us as a state to think again about that program and what services we do or don't offer through it. And it's a very it's a very disheartening place, again, for staff to be. They were 100% behind the redesign and the policy results that it was designed to achieve, and now we're in a place where we are really working hard just to get people eligible for the program because the caseload increases have been so significant. So again, that's one of our challenges that we are really working toward addressing. But we're going to need some help, I think, from all of you. We are increasingly working to improve our ability to meet individual family needs, and for us, as the diversity of our state grows, so do the challenges for us in terms of meeting individual family needs. That's particularly an issue for us in child welfare. We created a diversity unit in CAF, so we have the ability to really prioritize and ensure culturally specific services. And again, that really means family specific, and that can not just involve race or gender, but we serve a lot of families with different values, and we need to be able to respond to that appropriately and effectively. And in child welfare, though, we do know that children of color and Native American children are disproportionately overrepresented, so we have a very dedicated effort going on, which I'm happy to tell you more about, to reduce disparities in our child welfare system for children of color and Native American children. In vocational rehabilitation, again, because of budget limitations, we've had to really change our approach to that program, and we've begun what the federal government calls an order of selection, which means we're prioritizing the clients we served based on the severity of their disability. To be served at this point in time, beginning January 15th of this year with vocational rehabilitative services in Oregon, you really must be the most significantly disabled, and we have criteria so that we can be consistent and have standardized approach across the state for doing that. But it's very disheartening, again, for staff. We anticipate serving about 35% fewer people in that program over the coming year as a result of the budget limitations that program is now facing. In child welfare, again, I'll be back, so I won't go into too much depth, but we're facing some serious challenges, but also some very exciting opportunities. We have developed a partnership with the Commission on Children and Families, and are reaching out with communities, including Head Start programs and other folks, to safely, and I want to emphasize that word, reduce the number of children in foster care. In Oregon, we bring more children into foster care nationally than many other states do, and we're trying to drill a little deeper into the data to say, why do we do that, and are there ways for us to keep children at home safely if that's possible, and can we reduce the length of time that children are in foster care and improve the time it takes for us to get them out of foster care. Part of a major part of that strategy also follows up on a policy direction the legislature in 07 gave us to improve our work with relatives, and we're really excited about some of the possibilities, and we've set a target of increasing our relative placements by 50% over the next 2 years in child welfare. So that's just a glimpse of where we're headed with that. I guess I would just summarize by saying that hundreds of thousands of Oregonians rely on CAF to meet their families' most basic needs and to keep their children safe, and it really is my privilege to serve the people of Oregon alongside some very dedicated people in this organization, and I look forward to working with you to do that the best way we can in these very difficult times. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Erin. Any questions? Representative Collin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, we can bring this back as you do further presentations, but I would be interested in the future in hearing a little bit more in the area of diversity and attempts to address dealing with families with different values, some examples of that. I'm just trying to understand that a little better, if we could get some
explanation. And she will be coming again.
I just wanted to put it on the agenda.
Great.
Thank you.
You bet.
And thank you, Erin. The last time I sat on a committee, that was in 2005, so I missed the 2007 changes in TANF, and I'm not sure what they are, but my question is, how long can someone be on TANF, and is it like a full employment type, they're paid a living wage or whatever while they're training and learning how to go out and get a job? I'm not sure what the changes have been and how long. And then if the client is on TANF, goes out, gets a job, falls back, do they start over again, or do they get one shot at it?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone. So a long answer to the question. I'll try to hit some highlights and then maybe have some staff follow up with you on some more of the detail. But I think some of the most significant changes that have occurred in the program, just to give you the whole picture, when welfare was reformed at the federal level a while back, and I think it's important to remember that in order to be eligible for what was previously referred to as welfare, what is now referred to as TANF, T-A-N-F, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, you must be a family. You must have a child. And when welfare was reformed, there was a strong emphasis at the federal level on improving work outcomes for parents, which is a very good thing to emphasize. I think what we learned over the period of implementation, about 10 years of running the program, the caseloads dropped significantly in Oregon. You heard me say that now we're serving almost around 21,000 people, but there was a point in time when it was far fewer than that. And what we learned is that the families that were still with us really were families with very significant barriers to employment, mental health and addiction issues. And some of the ways the program was designed previously here in Oregon following federal mandates was not conducive to those families being successful moving ahead with their employment outcomes. And in fact, we also learned about a very frightening connection between those families who were on TANF and our child welfare program. When I started, I guess I would say it's probably in 2003 and 2005 when we started looking deeper into this, we saw that about 25% of children who were in foster care had previously been on the TANF program within the last 12 months. That's a very significant number, and that's why we started talking about TANF differently and calling it a child abuse prevention program. Families are being served in this program. Family stability can result in less harm to children and more safety for families. And so some very enlightened legislators worked very hard with us in 07 to redesign the program after the federal government issued new rules. And we had concerns that those rules would do further damage to our ability to serve families. So we worked very hard to design a program in Oregon that could meet the federal requirements, because it is a federal program, but also serve the family needs that we had identified here in Oregon as being most pressing and most significant. So we did a couple of things that I think really changed the way the program is run. We created a program that specifically acknowledges that people with disabilities on a voluntary basis who might otherwise qualify for disability assistance should be able not to have to go through the process of continuing to seek employment if we know it's very unlikely that employment will be achieved for that person. So people with very significant disabilities can volunteer to go on a different track with our emergency cash assistance program, and that has been very successful for those folks while we qualify for them for their federal benefits, which allows us to focus our track around employment on people who are most employable and who will be working and who can ultimately achieve their goals around employment. We created also a program that is called Family Supports and Connections, which is a referral to the criteria for referral are, in fact, identifying some of the risk factors that are often associated with our cases that end up in child welfare. It's not adequate. We anticipated originally that we would have around 400 referrals to that program per quarter. The last quarter I checked, we had 900. So we're not able to meet the needs of every family that we have identified within the TANF program, probably could use some early intervention to avoid a foster care placement. However, for those families that we can serve, it's incredibly helpful. We also redesigned our jobs program, which is the employment track that most families in TANF are on, and we designed it differently so that we could do a better job of removing barriers to employment and also offer opportunities for people, if they do end up coming back on the program, to advance in employment and not just end up in a job that keeps them at the bottom of the ladder in terms of their wage and economic earning potential. And finally, one of the most important pieces in my view is that we formally recognized, and I vividly remember the gentleman who testified who had four children, who talked about getting his children back after he had been a child welfare involved, being on the TANF program, getting employed, and then as soon as he was employed, his cash assistance ended, and so did child care subsidies as well as medical benefits as well as several other things. And all of a sudden, he was a single father with four children trying to make ends meet on a very low-paying job and all alone doing that. And he was very much at risk of losing his children again. And so you created the post-TANF program that provides some continuity of a very small cash subsidy. The cash subsidy, by the way, you asked, while you're on TANF, is around $496. So no, it is not a living wage. But the cash subsidy when you leave TANF is $150, designed to help you pay utilities and some of those upfront costs that are associated with things like child care and rent. And you also can continue to receive your child care subsidy as well as medical benefits for up to a year after you leave the TANF program. So incredibly positive changes in the TANF program as a result of the 2007 legislature, and I'd be happy to come back and provide you with some other details as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
One
Mauer.
Follow-up to that, the length of time that they can be on TANF, because she asked that specifically.
At the federal level, there is a lifetime limit for TANF benefits of 5 years.
Any other questions? Thank you so much, Aaron, for giving us this great overview, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you, Chair Dunman.
You bet. James Taves is going to talk with us about... Oh, you don't look like James Taves.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I apologize. I am not James Taves. I am Kathy Cooper. I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities. And Mr. Taves was called to Washington, D.C. on some urgent business and was unable to make it to this meeting this morning. I do appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. In your packet is the green packet. So I'll be following along the materials there. We had an opportunity last Friday when Mr. Taves was able to come in front of this committee and talk at length about some of the challenges that our division is facing. So I will try not to be repetitive, but hopefully add some dimension to the information you received from us last week. Seniors and People with Disabilities serves seniors, people 65 and older if they are on the Medicaid program, 60 or older if they are served through our Older Americans Act program and our Oregon Project Independence program, and individuals with physical disabilities 18 to 65. We also serve a number of people in our developmental disabilities program. Our developmental disabilities programs serve people from birth to death, and they are across the lifespan. Typically, people with developmental disabilities are defined as individuals with mental retardation, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, autism, or some other impairment of the brain that occurred during childhood. So those are the populations that are served by seniors and people with disabilities. We have three major program areas.
seniors and people with physical disabilities, services to developmental disabilities, and the program support that sort of ties everything together and makes our system operate. We have different federal and state fund sources, so our programs vary depending upon those federal and state regulations. Some of the programs that we have in Oregon are Older Americans Act programs. It's a 100% federally funded program. Most visible to most communities in Oregon is through our area agencies on aging. We do congregate meal sites. We do home-delivered meals, other nutrition and prevention programs. We help with senior employment programs through our Older American Act services. We do a number of direct financial supports for individuals of low income. Those are typically through eligibility programs that we operate. Erin Kelly Seal did a wonderful job of explaining the food stamp and other programs, the medical Oregon Health Plan to you. We do the eligibility for those programs for seniors and all people with disabilities across the state. And we also do long-term care services, and we spent some time last Friday discussing with you our long-term care system. And I did put on page 3 definitions of our community-based facilities, and I appreciated that question last Friday from the committee. And I have put on page 3 definitions of our aging and physically disabled community-based care facilities, as well as our developmental disability services. And you can see in that description, those range from typically home-like settings of 5 or fewer in a licensed facility up to large congregate assisted living or nursing facilities of hundreds or more people in one under one roof in one care setting. Our long-term care services, as we described last Friday, consist of both our in-home program, where we serve almost 11,000 people, our congregate or our community-based facilities, where we serve over 10,000, and our nursing facility programs, where we serve about 5,000 individuals. We also, in our developmental disabilities programs, through federal waivers, which are allowable, where the state is allowed to take Medicaid dollars, and instead of serving people through an institutional setting, and the two types of institutional setting are nursing facilities, or for developmental disabilities, they are called intermediate care facilities for individuals with mental retardation. In Oregon, we only have one left. That is our Eastern Oregon Training Center that at the beginning of this biennium had 38 individuals with developmental disabilities. And today we have about 20 individuals in that setting. By the end of next biennium, we will have closed the last institutional setting in Oregon for individuals with developmental disabilities, thereby serving all people with developmental disabilities in community-based settings. We do two major waivers under our developmental disabilities program. One is called our comprehensive services. These are 24-hour supervised care settings for individuals with developmental disabilities, where we're able to provide them not only care in their living setting, but also help them with community inclusion activities, with vocational services, with sheltered services, and actual employment services. We also, as the result of a lawsuit back in 2000, which was known as the Staley versus Kitzhaber lawsuit, we were able to settle that lawsuit, and we have been able to get a waiver from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and now we provide support services for people with developmental disabilities in their own homes. And right now we're serving almost almost 5,000 individuals through our support services waiver. We hope by the end of next biennium to have all individuals that are currently on a wait list for those services to be off a wait list and will be served by their own personal agents and by our brokerages, which are private nonprofit partners across the state. And then from then on, individuals that present themselves to us with a developmental disability will have access to support services in their home as adults from then on out, as soon as we have completed our wait list and have all of those individuals off the wait list. The third program area is our program supports, and it really is our four offices within our division that supports our two major programs, services to seniors and people with physical disabilities, services to individuals with developmental disabilities, and then our licensing and regulatory and quality part that does oversight on all of our licensed facilities in the state of Oregon, which is a major responsibility of our organization. So how our services are delivered. Erin talked a little bit about our Children, Adults, and Families program, where the majority of the individuals are state employees. In seniors and people with disabilities, our providers of our local services are primarily our area agencies on aging for our aged and physically disabled programs. We have state offices in every area where the AAAs do not provide services. And for our developmental disabilities programs, we provide those services through our county developmental disabilities programs. In some counties, those are county-run programs, and in others, those are nonprofit programs that are contracted through the counties to provide those services. We do eligibility for financial eligibility for food stamps and for Oregon Health Plan for all seniors and for all people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. So we do all the eligibility that's not done by the CAF program in the state, and we pick up the other major component. In our offices today, we also do the eligibility for our developmental disabilities programs. We're seeing about a 6% increase over the last year in individuals presenting with developmental disabilities for services. And in our aged and physically disabled program, much like the CAF offices, we're seeing families in crisis right now coming in for any assistance they can get for their loved ones and family members that are finding themselves in financial difficulties. We're seeing, unlike CAF, we're seeing many more people present for services, but many people are still not eligible because of the financial eligibility requirements for our programs and our services. We also provide case management for all of the populations we serve. We do that through either our state offices, our AAA offices, or our community programs for developmental disabilities. We also do our Older Americans Act program, and we serve over 300,000 Oregonians through our Older Americans Act programs, through congregate meals, nutrition programs, legal services, senior employment programs. And then our major portion of our service delivery is our long-term care services, where we actually assist individuals either in their home or in community settings with their activities of daily living, either individuals that need substantial assistance with activities, people that need minimal assistance, or people that need literally full assistance around a 24-hour need. Those are all done through our in-home or through our community-based setting. We serve over 26,000 people in our aged and physically disabled program through our long-term care services, and on our developmental disability services, we serve over 17,000 individuals, both adults, about 12,000 adults, and about 4,600 children with developmental disabilities in our programs. As I mentioned, another really important component of our service delivery is to ensure that the quality of those services and the protection of the individuals that are in those services is met, whether those individuals are people receiving Medicaid services or whether they're private individuals receiving services within the state of Oregon. So our division licenses and certifies over 5,000 different community-based settings in Oregon, and it requires that we're in there both monitoring their health and safety requirements for the clients, their staffing, and also their physical plan to meet fire and other health and safety requirements. And I've given you a little bit of a breakout of where those facilities are and the number of and types of those facilities, and then the number of those facilities on the aged and physically disabled side that actually serve our Medicaid population. We also have many challenges. Last Friday, we had the opportunity to begin the discussion with you about long-range planning that we have been doing since 2005 in our division and has culminated in a bill that came out of this committee during the interim session, House Bill 1061. But our challenges remain immense as we face some of the difficult budget that we are all aware of. We, too, unlike people would sometimes believe, because many people come to us and literally stay on our services throughout the lifetime, we really spend a great deal of our service time helping people with preventive services, helping them to become as independent and as healthy and as safe as they possibly can in the most unrestrictive settings as they possibly are able to do. And so our challenges are around the demographics that face all of us, as we talked about last Friday. We believe that prevention is the key to reducing the number of people that go into long-term care services in our Medicaid program in the future. We talked to you last week a little bit about the issues we have around our community-based facilities and those choosing not to serve Medicaid because of our rates. We also are losing capacity because our providers are seeing that it's much easier and they can get a better dollar to serve individuals from the private sector, and so we are trying to find ways to do more development around specialized community-based settings that will be able to address a number of the impairments we're seeing more and more in the population we're serving. An example is that of individuals with traumatic brain injury. We have a number of people that are obese, that need bariatric services, that find themselves only being served in nursing facilities just because we have not been able to develop a community-based service that would allow them either to return home or into their home communities. And then we continue to spend a lot of our time and energy on protection of vulnerable adults, and we really are looking more at improving our licensing and regulatory function to make sure that we're continuing to make sure that all of our facilities are making sure that individuals are there, are in the most healthy and safe environment. And we talked last Friday to you a little bit about the long-term issues we have around workforce. With that, I could go on in much detail. I've given you a number of graphs and charts that just give you a depiction by county and by service setting and by our services. But with that, I think I will stop and allow any questions that you might have of me.
Great. Any questions of this?
Yes. I just have one, and you mentioned seniors over 65 on the health plan. Wouldn't they be getting Medicare for health services?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you brought that up. We actually do provide services to individuals that receive Medicare, especially since January of 2006. There was the major change to the Medicare program that's famously now known as Part D, which changed the allowance for people to receive their prescription drugs. We also serve individuals that are described as dual eligibles, those both individuals that have Medicare and are also eligible for Medicaid. Medicare becomes the payer of first payment, and then we do any supplemental payments. So in the Medicare program, there are Parts A and Parts B that are for low-income subsidy individuals, where we, the state of Oregon, pay for their premiums for their Medicare services, thereby purchasing that at a much reduced rate, and it allows us to get the services through Medicare first, and then we come in as the payer of last resort with the Medicaid dollar. And I appreciate your question. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I know that one of the things that your agency is responsible for with the developmentally disabled is interfacing with educational services for the young people. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and ways in which that the smooth connections are maintained that way. And I ask that because I visited a facility in East Multnomah County, the Pathways School. It's run by the ESD. And just people doing really admirable work. And I detected perhaps not as much communication as one might have hoped between the caregivers, or the educators, the teachers at that facility, and the caregivers in the residential facilities at which the children were living outside of school. And is that the responsibility of the case manager to maintain that kind of communication, or, you know, are there ways that, you know, through electronic communication we can be improving that that nexus? Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. Madam Chair, Representative Dembro, it is an excellent question, and we find ourselves many times in trying to determine the collaborative relationship. It is true that children up to the age of 18 and then individuals with developmental disabilities that are still in school settings, could be up to the age of 21, are ultimately the responsibility of the education system. But we too, as part of the long-term care system, have the responsibility for their activities of daily living, making sure and ensuring they're getting not only the proper education but the life skills components they need. It would be the responsibility of our community developmental disabilities program at the county level to do that and interface with the education system. And again, it is done differently by different counties and different programs, but you raise an excellent point that if we're aware that an individual with developmental disabilities could benefit from a service, we do have family support services, there might be something going on in their home, that we might be able to go in with some respite services, we might be able to go in with some adaptive technology that could smooth maybe some of the issues that they're facing while they're in the school setting. And it is about that communication and that collaboration. And so I appreciate your question, and clearly it's something that we could bring back to our program managers to make sure that we continue to have that communication happen.
Great. Thank you. Any last question? Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We'll move on to Richard Harris from Addictions and Mental Health. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Richard Harris. I'm the Interim Assistant Director for Addictions and Mental Health. I am very happy to be here this morning, Chair Tomei and representatives. I'm fairly new to the state of Oregon, but I have spent 40 years. In fact, I was celebrating my 40th year in
serving addictions and mental health people in the community. When I was retiring in October and Dr. Goldberg asked me if I would consider coming here to take this job, I thought long and hard about that since I was basically looking forward to a rest after 40 years of being in this business. But I found this to be a challenge that I have grown to appreciate more since I came here in October, even though we have some really significant challenges in our economy and the effects here in the state of Oregon. But I also believe that the services provided in Division of Human Services, and particularly in addictions and mental health, are so very important to the many things that we do in the state of Oregon that I've taken this as my life challenge at this point is to move forward in some way to make the best out of our system that we possibly can. So I'm going to try to be brief and just an overview of the organization, and I think that Dr. Goldberg had elicited some questions from you about the addictions and mental health services that I would hope to, if you have other questions, I could answer perhaps as we go through this. Really, the mission of addictions and mental health is to prevent and reduce negative effects of alcohol and other drugs, gambling, mental health disorders, and promote recovery through culturally competent, integrated, evidence-based treatments for addiction, pathological gambling, mental illness, and emotional disorders. That's the official mission. What we're really in business to do is save lives, and we're also in the business to try to figure out how to save resources. One of the things that I think has become obvious to many people is that addictions and mental illness are pervasive in the community, and they have unintended consequences in particularly costs to much of the system, the healthcare system, the community justice system, and it results in, when we have untreated, particularly addictions, in huge costs to other systems in the community. So I think part of our task should be to create an effective system that reduces its cost to other systems in the community. Our main goal is to promote health and self-sufficiency through active intervention and treatment, and that we're focused on individuals, but we also must be aware that if we're successful, we do have an impact in the rest of the community. We try to measure our success in some fairly simplistic ways, and I think that we're moving more in that direction all the time. And one is to note how stable people become. Do they have housing? Do they have income? Do they have employment opportunities? Are they involved in the criminal justice system less? And do we keep families together? So I'd like to go to the graphics that we put in, you have in front of you. Unlike CAF, most of our services are provided through our partners in the community, with the exception, of course, the state institutions, the state hospital, who are direct employees of the state of Oregon. So if we looked at the first chart here, where we have addiction services on the left, there are a variety of services that we provide to people that are posed in a way to provide a continuum in the community of services to help people deal with their addiction problems. On the right-hand side of the paper, we have the mental health services. This is a way of showing that these services are separated, but in reality, they are interactive with one another, and that many people have both addiction issues and mental health issues. So it's not just that you're involved in one system or the other. People may be involved in mental health services as well as addiction services. First, on the prevention side, we've attempted to reach many people in the community, and we do this through a variety of prevention programs with schools and independent of schools. But over 200,000 people were contacted in the last year with prevention services. If you took the assessment, outpatient treatment, and counseling services for addictions, over 57,000 people receive services, direct services for their addiction. And then detoxification, which is the basic first step for many people with late-stage addictions, we served over 6,700 individuals. Supported housing, which is a new element that we've been working towards in the state for some time. There are over 2,200 units of supportive housing for people with addictions, Oxford houses, as well as other alcohol and drug-free communities. And the state has been very helpful in creating additional resources by providing both capital funds and rent assistance, particularly to families who are in recovery. If you look at the intensive treatment side, which includes A and D residential, involving both single adults and families, there were over 770 individuals who actually went through residential programs, and that had a big impact on whether moms were able to keep their children or parents were able to keep their children in the welfare system for families. On the mental health side, we have in the early psychosis and assessment treatment, which was a project that was funded out of the last legislature, which has proven to be very effective. There were 180 individuals who were proactively worked with as a way to keep them out of hospitals, and we're now gathering the data about that, and I'd like to bring that back at some time. We could have a discussion how that program is working. Good. It appears to be very effective. We also, in the mental health side, of course, we have to respond to the crises as they occur for individuals in communities, and so every community has some level of crisis intervention services, which are designed to take people who are in some level of mental health crisis, resulting in sometimes hospitalization. So there were over 6,000 acute care hospitalizations of individuals in the community. In the intensive community-based treatment and support services for children, there were over 2,300 individuals who were served in community systems, including residential and intensive outpatient programs. On the mental health side, we also had over 2,000 people that were diverted from jail system into the mental health services. And we had managed to develop, and this is another new area, over 600 units of community-based housing, most of this housing being an intensive housing for either 8, 16-bed, or group home-sized places, and much of that designed really around helping get people out of the state hospital and out of PSRB, Psychiatric Security Review Board. The Supported Employment Program, which is a new initiative in the last few years, has been, we served over 1,300 individuals there. And in residential treatment, we served approximately 2,700 folks on an annual basis. So in total, the outpatient services, we served over 40,000 people in the community last year. So at the bottom of this chart, we have the state hospital, and the legislature has made a significant investment in the state hospital, and you need to know that the state hospital is active, even though we're in the process of building a new state hospital. We still have the state hospital right now, who is serving approximately 1,600 individuals. So it brings us to the question of serving all of these people in various different programs. Are we really meeting the need? And so I provided this chart because I think it's instructive that even though we've made a big investment in mental health and addiction services, we're really only scratching the surface of the need that people have. And the evidence of that ends up being in what happens in our jails and how many people are ending up there as a result of untreated addiction. So if you take the prevalence rates, and these are based on scientific prognosticators that other states have used as well as Oregon, you can see that the prevalence is much higher than the number of people that are being served. So I only show this to you because I think Because we're going to be faced with the issue of how we manage the system going forward in the next year, we're starting out way behind, and we have fewer services than the people of Oregon need. If you go to the next page, where we're looking at a graph of the way the system works, one of the things that's quite different from other parts of DHS is that we're reliant mostly upon community providers to deliver the services, and these come through our relationship both statutorily and historically with the counties. Counties are, in fact, have their own mental health authority, and they have obligations under the statute to serve people with mental illness, and that it's a partnership with AMH. We do and are responsible for those contracts, and we're responsible for licensure of the providers. Most of the providers in the system are either counties directly themselves or are nonprofit organizations that have grown up over the years to serve both addicts, alcoholics, and people with mental illness. But we also operate the state hospital system directly, and we have many employees there, and we have many challenges in operations of those facilities that are different from the community-based facilities. And at some time, you're going to want, I believe, to talk to the hospital, Roy Orr, and his and Linda about the progress of the state hospital and how we're going with that project. And I would just report today that it's on time and it's on budget and is progressing in the right direction. It is, however, a service for mandated individuals, and we are obligated in both legally and moral ways to improve that hospital and move forward. And as you know, there's a planned second hospital in Junction City, which we're proceeding to move forward with now. But in addition to the state hospital system, there are a variety of other acute care systems that are operated mostly by private hospitals and nonprofit organizations in the community. But if you look at this, you'll see that much of our service is funded in part by Medicaid as well as state general fund, and that the contracted services down through the county provide a variety and a continuum of basic services. So people enter through multiple doors. There isn't just one way to get into the system. People come through the criminal justice system. They come through the crisis services. They enter into outpatient services voluntarily, and some people are mandated into services by the court. The services that we are providing are based on not only population-specific, but also age-specific. So there's really a separate service system that are serving people underneath the 18 years of age, and that system has received considerable remodeling over the last few years, so that it is mostly now in a managed care model where the adult system is mostly in a system that's operated by the counties through nonprofit providers. So I wanted to spend just a few minutes about some of the outcomes, because I think these are the things that we track and we see as indicators of being success. And that is that we want people to live in stable housing in the community, and that when people come into treatment, they're more likely to find housing in a stable way and then stay in that housing and not go back and recycle through the system. So you can see from the first chart here that people have a better opportunity to be engaged in services and stay in housing. This is an indication that their services are working. They're not recycling back into the community. If you go to the next chart, it's really about do people become employed? And I think there are some mythology about people with mental illness, and we believe that, in fact, they are disabled to the point where they don't work, but we know that's not true. Our goal is to make sure everybody is able to work at the level that they're capable of, and we want to assist them to do that the best we can. And there are many crossovers in the vocational rehab services provided by CAF to help people with those goals. And as you can see here, people who are in services have a much better opportunity to become employed. In the mental health, we have learned that it's not a crime to be mentally ill, but one of the service providers of last resort is the jail systems in our communities. People end up there when they're not in services. So our goal is to reduce the number of people that come in contact with the criminal justice system. It isn't the place to be providing mental health services in our jails, even though that is one of the functions that occurs now. So we recognize that when you have people in treatment, they're much less likely to be involved in the criminal justice system.
Representative Wilson has a question.
Richard, your goal for the outcome on this is to reduce that for incarceration. Do you have a percentage?
Well, as you can see, if about 8% of the population with mental illness end up in some level in incarceration, and what we were trying to do is get it down. I would like it to be zero. But realizing we have many people that we don't get into the system, we're never going to get it to zero. But my hope would be to reduce that to the absolute minimum.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Richard.
Employment service for people in addiction. For people who completed treatment, they're much more likely to be engaged in employment, and that, in fact, they return to as you may suppose, people with addictions frequently have worked and are working, but they don't have very good work history. So once they get into recovery, and their ability to perform in the workplace goes way up. Is that me, or is that?
If anybody has a cell phone on or a BlackBerry, could you turn it off? It affects the sound system. Is that you, Richard?
I thought I turned it off. So. Yeah, it's off. So okay. So employment is a goal that we are pushing for, and the data indicates that once people complete treatment, they have a much improved work history and are able to go to work. Because so many people with addictions end up in the criminal justice system, and I'm sure you've heard some of these numbers before, but at least 70% of the people in our prisons are there because of some relationship to their addictions or in the drug business themselves. And if, in fact, you can get people in treatment, you would expect fewer people to be arrested. This is an artifact that we pay close attention to, and that is, we want people in treatment, and we know that it reduces their arrests or crimes that they commit afterwards. At the agency I was at before coming here at Central City Concern in Portland, we'd commissioned a study from Portland State to do a post and pre and post history of people in the addictions treatment program. This is an outpatient program with supportive housing. In terms of the number of crimes they committed, and we placed a value on those crimes. In the case, there was a 95% reduction in the crimes committed. Now, this is not just arrests or adjudications. This is actually talking to people about how many crimes they commit to support their habits. And as you would suspect, people with drug addiction problems are commit a lot of crimes to support that habit. And once and after treatment, that falls to practically zero, the number of crimes committed. But what was really significant about it is that in a group of about 100 individuals, it saved over $12 million in thefts alone to the community. So it has a big impact if we can get people clean and sober and functioning, employed in the community. So those are a few of the outcomes that we're striving for. I look forward to more discussions with the committee at time and an opportunity to meet all of you individually. After spending so much time out there in the community providing services, I think the challenges here for the state can be resolved, and that we have lots of good ideas about where we might make improvements in the system, at least to get more effective programs out there and perhaps less costly. However, we still are way behind in terms of the number of people we're serving. So,
right. Any quick questions? Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you again. We're running out of time. Bill Coulomb. Thank you, Bill. And if we can't get to Jim Edge, Jim, we'll ask you to come another time. But maybe we can speed through.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Coulomb, Deputy Director for Public Health. Dr. Cohn sends his apologies. He, too, was called away and is on the East Coast. So I'm here to give you a five-minute presentation on Public Health Division, and with that, hopefully give you a few moments for questions. Public Health Division provides a range of services whose common purpose is to improve and protect the health and safety of the community, with an emphasis on prevention and early intervention. So with those last two words, prevention and early intervention, I've seen a theme here of the department where we're sort of trying to address the community needs from a cohesive level, and again, emphasizing prevention so as to not have to try to deal with things when they reach a more chronic and expensive stage. Within the Public Health Division, there are programs and services with a great diversity in the nature of the programs, as well as how the services are delivered. Most of our public health services, much like our partners in AMH, are population-based and provided at the community level through our local 34 health departments. Other community-based services that are also provided are through community-based coalitions and organizations, and then those services that the DHS Public Health Division is directly responsible for or are the direct provider of service are generally regulatory in nature or those that require professional oversight. You've only been given from Public Health a one-page exhibit, and with that, because of course we've got a plethora of information that we'll probably be providing into the Ways and Means presentation, but if you would like, you can follow that Public Health Program area, which is basically structured by office, and what we've attempted to do is to try to be able to give you a summary of what each office is responsible for under the principles of areas that the local health departments are trying to address in your community. That is child health, prevention, communicable disease, accesses to care, environmental health, and then the licensing and regulation. So I'm going to try to give you a very brief overview of what each office sort of encompasses at a program level that you're likely to be familiar with, and it's not intended to be an exhaustive list by any means. Of course, the Office of the State Public Health Director is responsible for the oversight and policy administration of the division, but this is also where our emergency preparedness program is housed, many of which you're familiar with is obviously taken a much greater role and greater emphasis after the events of 9/11. The Office of Community Health and Health Planning is in place to promote access to health care services, particularly for vulnerable populations. This office has assisted in the establishment of new community health center access points, expanded services in existing health centers, opening of rural health clinics, and provides placement of physicians in hard-to-reach areas of the communities of needs. This office also has the responsibility for some of the regulatory functions, such as healthcare licensure, certificate of need, as well as the medical marijuana program and emergency medical services for the licensure and certification of EMTs. Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology is the key to communicable disease control in its rapid and effective investigation of disease outbreak, which our epidemiologists conduct in close collaboration with local health departments. And as many of you have probably seen a recent outbreak of salmonella, the office is tracking very closely with being able to trace that back to the contamination of peanut butter. Within ODPE, or Office of Disease Prevention Epidemiology, is the Health Promotion Chronic Disease Prevention. And here's where they try to monitor chronic disease and risk factors that help promote screenings where appropriate and help improve the health of Oregonians. The chronic disease currently covers areas such as asthma, tobacco use, arthritis, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. Another key element that is housed within epidemiology that you're going to be very familiar with, is the Center for Health Statistics. And the Center for Health Statistics is responsible for tracking and issuing all of the vital records of Oregon, birth certificates, death certificates. And all that data is collected in order for us to be able to assess and monitor where we are in Oregon's morbidity and mortality. Office of Environmental Health oversees the 34 county health departments in the licensure and inspection of restaurants, such as commissaries, as well as mobile food vendors, basically ensuring that the food is safe for the public consumption. Again, within environmental health, we have radiation protection, and this is a state-run program. This is not something that counties are responsible for, but this is entirely a state program that helps protect workers and the public from unnecessary and unhealthy radiation exposure. Probably key to the environmental health and a real pivotal element in public health is the drinking water program, working to ensure that safe drinking water is available to communities and be reducing the risk of waterborne disease and potential exposures to chemicals. And in the Office of Family Health, this is a big emphasis on prevention and child health. We provide immunizations and vaccines, family planning services to local health departments through local health departments and community clinics. Public health nurses are in place in local health departments to attempt repeated visits for the high-risk women for prenatal care and education to assist them in having a healthy birth. The Women, Infant, and Children Program, otherwise known as WIC, serves lower-income pregnant, postpartum, and breastfeeding women to the age of 5, and basically it's a nutrition and health education information program, but they receive the vouchers for both food subsidy as well as for infant formula. And then lastly, we have the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory, which, of course, performs millions of tests in the area of metabolic screening on every single newborn in Oregon, as well as having a nationally recognized program where we contract with 5 other states, Alaska, Hawaii, Nevada, and Idaho, to do their metabolic screening as well. And I know that Dr. Skeels will probably be talking before the committee before the end of session as well. The State Health Laboratory also provides and coordinates laboratory response to emergencies and threats for other elements that are found. For example, here, I think in the last 30 days or so, there was powder found at the state capitol, and of course that sampled through the coordination of state police as well as the emergency preparedness folks was taken to the state laboratory for diagnosis. But we also do laboratory licensure and such for the laboratory accreditation program through our state laboratory. Some of the policy issues and issues that, of course, this committee as well as the legislature is going to probably be seeing in various forms, whether it be through bills and community interests and such, and as well as through our budget, are going to be the continuous challenges in tobacco as well as the new and emerging challenges for public health, such as obesity, climate change, environmental factors, health disparities, which was addressed earlier, emergency preparedness, and again, the chronic diseases that follow with diabetes, arthritis, cardiovascular, that become the prominent and leading cause of illness and disability. State and local health departments need to find new ways to bring additional attention to the importance of the health promotion and prevention of these conditions, at the same time maintaining support of the health and the traditional public health programs. Providing necessary information and data is critical to many of the citizens as well as policymakers in attempting to meet these challenges. At present, the public health system is struggling in the local communities. Of course, over the last 12 months, many of you have been personally engaged with some of the challenges that county health departments have faced with the timber task revenue issue that we were trying to address earlier this year. But even with that, the revenue and or support that the state gives to local health departments truly is pennies on the dollar as to what it costs in order to be able to ensure safe public health across the entire community. And with that, if you have any questions, I guess I went over my 5 minutes.
Quick questions. I have a question. Bill, how many people are employed in your department? I know many of the services go through the counties, but how many in the state?
At the state level, the public mm-hmm. health division has approximately 700 FTE.
Okay, great. And at some point, I would be very interested in talking about the pandemic flu, the potential of that coming into Oregon and how we are preparing for that, as well as I think Representative Boone has worked in the past about emergency issues. So I'd be very interested in that at some point.
Okay. Chair Kamei would be happy to give you an update on that.
Great. Any other quick questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jim, I'm sorry. We'll get you another day. All right. Thanks again. Thanks for everybody who testified. And thank you, committee. And I will close the House Committee on...